we pay artists crap, you know? And in truth, it's nothing but work. That's all it is. All creativity can be created. Literally, you can create yourself. Life isn't about discovering yourself. Life is about creating yourself. This is George Bernard Shaw. He said that. And I totally believe that. Because every day you wake up, you're a new person. You may be high, you may be low, but you are different. You're always different. And it's up to you to say, who am I today? Am I a writer? Then I better write. Am I an artist? I better draw. You know? Maybe they're not going to pay you. Maybe they will never pay you. But you don't know unless you do the job and you work at it.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Loving Creative Podcast. I am your host, Kamga Chasa. And on this episode of the podcast, I sit with Elena Tucker, my friend who I met on Medium, and we got a chance to hang out once, and ever since we've always looked for opportunities to actually hang out and have coffee and talk about books and writing and all the other cool creative stuff. So finally, we got a chance to sit down and record one of these conversations in which Elena got to tell me some of the things that she's already told me, but I thought that you would enjoy listening to them. For example, Elena and I actually shared this bond because we're immigrants. She left Minsk, Belarus when she was 12 years old with her family and moved to the US and actually lived in Denver in Colorado. And she's been here ever since. We talked on this episode about the first time she saw a color TV, when she saw a limo, how she eventually became a writer, and a bunch of other things that really resonate with me as a creative and someone who might not have been able to do what I wanted to do for a long time. I think the big takeaway that I got from this episode was really about the fact that being a creative is work. You're not born a creative. You work your way through it. And through Elena's story, I hope you find the courage. I hope you find the energy, the inspiration from someone who was able to leave from a difficult place in life and end up doing what she really cares about. And I'm looking forward to bringing Elena back on the podcast when her book is out. Without wasting much of your time, let's get straight into this episode of The Loving Creative with Elena Tucker. Hello, Helena.
Hi, Kamga.
Thank you so much for accepting to be on the Loving Creative Podcast.
Thank you. It's an honor.
Okay. So, let's begin from the beginning. I almost said the beginning. So, for those of us who don't know you, could you tell us where you grew up and how you ended up being in the position in which you are today?
I was born in Minsk, Belarus. It used to be a Soviet Socialist Republic. And my family and I emigrated when I was 12 years old to Denver, actually, to Colorado. And I grew up in Colorado. I've lived in Missouri and in Iowa and came back to Colorado to raise my kids. And I discovered Medium just by accident, started reading it, became a member, decided to write for it, and it was probably one of the best decisions I've ever made.
Okay. So have you always been a writer, reader, artist person?
I've always been a reader since I was three. My mom had to teach me to read because I wouldn't leave her alone. Kept bugging her, and she was a working woman. So she taught me to read at three, and I knew I was going to be a writer at 10, 12. As far as being an artist, I can copy really well, but I can't create. So I could be an animator, but I can't be an artist.
Okay. Well, I remember the first time we met. We actually met through Medium, where I read an article and discovered, hey, you're in Aurora. And I think, I don't know if I left a comment or you left a comment or something happened. But then I said, let's meet. And you said, yes. And I picked a spot and we came. And then you told me this beautiful story about the first time you saw a TV. I would like to actually, if you could, you know, tell me that story again, moving from Belarus to here, like the whole journey of immigration.
Oh, you know, okay, we're Jewish, we're Jews. In Russia, there's not a lot of professions available to Jews. You can be a nurse, you can be an engineer. That's it. It's not a hell of a lot. I wasn't greatly talented in many, many things. And my father, who lost his father in World War II, wanted to get out. He knew the inhumanity of the communist regime. He knew what it is, the system. He wanted to immigrate for a very long time. My grandfather, my mom's father, was blind. He couldn't see. And he said, I don't want to come to America. In Russia, I can't see. In America, I will be blind and deaf. But if your only daughter wants to go with your only granddaughter, you go. And so my mom's parents, my parents and I, and I'm an only child, got permission in record time of 3 months. And we were lucky.
Usually, what year was that?
1976. We were lucky in that sometimes when a person asks to leave Mother Russia, they lose everything. They lose their jobs, they lose their apartments, they lose whatever they have. If they have a car, which we didn't, they lose that. My dad did not lose his job. My mom did not lose her job. We were lucky in that neither of my parents were members of the Communist Party. My grandfather was. He was the old-time communist like Trotsky, not Stalin. But we had our own apartment. We moved into our own apartment when I was 5 years old. I mean, we had our own bathroom and our own kitchen, unheard of. It was a tiny little apartment, and my mom loved it with her own. And when we asked to emigrate, Russia didn't even have an Israeli embassy. So my dad had to go to like a Danish or Swedish embassy and on their behalf go through Israel.
Why did you have to go through an Israeli embassy?
Because if you're Jews and you say we're Jews and we want to emigrate, this is where you go. You go to Israel. When we left Russia, we left from Minsk on a train through a city called Brest. Brest is right on the border of Poland and Belarus. And once we came into Poland, my dad got off the train. He said, I'll be right back. And then 15 minutes later, he still wasn't there. And I was crying. I was worried. He comes back and he has this bottle, this brown bottle. I've never seen a bottle like this before. He said, you have to try this. And I tried this and it was magical. It was Coca-Cola. I never had a soda before. I was 12 years old. In America, of course, when I got to ketchup, that was a thing too. I've never had ketchup before. Became instantly addicted. But my first taste of Coke, it was alive in my mouth. I will never forget it. We went through Poland, into Germany, Czechoslovakia at the time, and then into Vienna. And in Vienna, they asked my father and they asked my grandfather, who were heads of the families, where they're going. And my father said America, because you had a choice here. You can say Israel or you can say America. My father said America. My grandfather said America. And they put us up in a hotel in Vienna for a week. It's an organization called HIAS. And they help Jews emigrate to either America or Canada or Israel, wherever. And we stayed a week in Vienna, and it was the most, I turned 12. It was, you know, 3 days before my birthday when we left. I turned 12, April 6, 1976. And first of all, we'd go into stores, and there was food there. I mean, there were apples and oranges and breads and cookies and chocolates. There was no food in Russian stores, Soviet stores, none.
What did you have in those stores?
Well, there was a pile of bread and a pile of potatoes and maybe some cabbage and dirty floors.
And that's it?
Pretty much.
Okay. So you're in Vienna and see all this chocolate and cookies food. And food.
And the owners of the stores would see me as a child, and they would give me free things. Like, I got a piece of free salami, or a little chocolate, or a balloon. I mean, it was like heaven for a child, for a kid. And then there was Vienna, which was Vienna of Mozart. You have these huge cathedrals made of stone and ancient, you know. I mean, Russia is old. Minsk, the city I was born in, is more than 900 years old. It's an old country. But this was old and marble. You know, this was class. Russia, there are parts of it that are still wood planks and wooden little houses. It's a different kind of old. This was old women wearing fur. Everybody had poodles. I think it's a law in Vienna. You have to own a poodle. It was just heaven.
For that week.
For that week. And then we went and we came to Italy. From Vienna, we took a train to Italy. In Italy, we spent 3 months while all the paperwork was organized.
Who paid for all this?
Like he us. And then when we got to the States, we paid it back. It's like an assumed loan. Some people don't pay it back. My parents are proud of the fact that they paid every penny back. And we still donate a little. He us sends us, and we you know, my husband and I think they found us. But we give them, you know, a little bit because you don't forget this was huge. In Italy, HIAS organization works with the mafia. The mafia is very open, you know. They don't care for the Jews so much, but they hate the communists even more. So 3 months in Italy, we shared a little apartment with another Russian family, rather Russian Jewish family. When I say Russian at this point, I mean Jewish. In Russia, I'm a Jew. In America, I'm a Russian. When I go to Europe, I'm an American.
Wherever you go, you have a different label.
Yep. So it was a mom, a dad, and they had two kids, a little older daughter and a boy who was 10, and I was 12. So the boy and I, we ran around, and we settled in this little little town right on the Mediterranean. It's called Ostia. And Ostia is where all the Romans come to be on the beach. Now, it's not a pretty town, but they don't have to be. It's right on the Mediterranean. You go to the beach, you're right there. My friend Misha and I, we spend the summer just getting tall. We were climbing fences and garages and trees. And a circus came to town once. And this is a big top. This isn't like a big top circus. Now, in Russia, circus is venerated. Every big city, Kiev, Odessa, Moscow, Minsk, have their own buildings for the circus. And you go to the circus. They don't come to you. Mm. They stay. Clowns have, they're not the kind of clowns like the America pie in the face kind of clowns. They have the routines, and they're famous all over the country. I mean, they, you know, they're honored, they're respected. And you have bears riding, playing hockey and riding. And Russians are so proud. We're so proud of their bears. They said the Russian bears could beat Canadian hockey team in hockey.
When did they say that?
They did. They said that.
Okay.
But this was a big top. The sawdust and like 1940s, you know. And it was, I took my grandfather and I narrated the whole thing to him so he could see it. And then at the end, we got to pet a little tiger cub. That was a huge highlight for a kid, you know. And it was not soft. It was a rough little fur, and it kept doing the meh, meh, like that. Oh, so sweet. Anyway, so after 3 months of doing all the paperwork, they said, where would you like to go? My mom said, anywhere but New York or Los Angeles. We don't want a big city because my grandfather is blind. We want a little place. So they said, well, Denver is open. Never heard of it. Never heard of Denver. The only thing we heard of is a Colorado bug. And Minsk is a potato growing place, so Colorado bugs ate potatoes. That's all we knew. Ironically, they're not even from Colorado.
Where are they from?
I have no idea where the Colorado bugs come from.
Okay.
I'm thinking Ireland, but...
McGregor.
Right? So we looked it up in an encyclopedia. And it looked very nice. And we flew from Rome, Roman airport to Da Vinci airport to New York. I think it was the Kennedy.
JFK.
JFK, yeah. And for the first time ever, I saw a car that was pretty much the size of my bedroom in the old country. And it had four doors on each side. This was a limo. I had no idea what it was. It was the hugest thing I've ever seen. Now in Russia, all the cars are little, except the government cars. They're fairly, you know, like us. They're big. Zhiguli is what everybody else has. They're tiny little cars. And, you know, you can, not everybody can afford a car. But so you had the big government cars and you had the itty bitty cars. But these were humongous. I saw a limo and I smelled the exhaust. This was America. You know, we were in New York. At night, I saw lights. When they put us in the hotel, I saw lights, and I thought, this must be Broadway. And we turned on the TV, and it was a color TV. We had a black and white TV in the old country. It was very little. My grandparents had a bigger color black and white TV. One time, we visited somebody who had a color TV, but they were watching a black and white movie.
Oh.
So I saw a little strip of color on the bottom, and I thought, this is color TV? This is not impressive. there was a show on called Adam 12. Adam 12 was about a police show. And in it, a man was hitting a woman. He was punching her. And I've never seen such violence against a woman. I was shaking. I've never seen this. And this was, you know, I was 12, and it really upset me. Of course, now I'm addicted to police shows.
Maybe it started there.
Yes. We took our first showers. We have never showered. In Russia, everybody takes a bath once a week like everyone else. Hmm. On Sundays, which is the only day off. And, but there we were taking showers. We had to figure it out. My dad figured it out, how to turn it on and off. And then I took my first shower. I love showers. To this day, I, even my druthers, will always take a shower over a bath. And then we spent one night in New York. We had family in New York. They emigrated 5 years earlier. And they came and they brought food and vodka and we celebrated. The next day, we flew into the Denver airport. Now, when we came into America and we were flying Pan Am, what I really wanted was a piece of gum. I had a friend whose mom would go to France and she would bring us back French
gum.
Chewing gum.
Yeah.
And I would take a piece of that gum. She would give me a piece. And I would take a piece of that gum and I would chew it for days. And I'd keep it in a glass of water. So, you know, hopefully preserve it as long as I can. And I remember my parents, forward thinking, put me in a school that taught English. But it was English, British English. Cinema and remember. And they taught us how terrible, terrible life was in America. This was during...
That was in New York?
No. This was in Russia.
Okay, before you moved. Okay.
Yeah. When we were flying from Italy to New York, I came to a stewardess and I said, may I have some gum, please? And she said, and I'll never forget this, she said, I'm sorry, I don't have any gum. Would you like a piece of candy? Which broke my heart. Candy. I had candy. I wanted American gum. When we came to the States for maybe 6 months, I thought that gum was free and I would take it. I wouldn't even hide it. We would go through the cash register and I would grab a pack of gum up until the point I saw somebody pay for it in front of me. And then it dawned on me that I've been stealing all this time.
And the cashiers were just like, well, just a kid.
I don't know if my mom would pay for it or I was so brazen that they just assumed. I have no idea. This is before electronics and everything had to be entered.
Like cards and everything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have no idea. To this day, I don't know whether I was stealing for months or my mom was paying for me. Because I would never go to the store alone or, you know, go with my parents. But yeah, it wasn't free.
The stewardess, did she give you candy?
She did. She gave me a piece of candy, but I almost cried. And we were watching a movie. Well, some people were watching a movie. And it was called Murder by Death. It had a whole slew of the Peter Falk, a whole slew of actors in it. They were fairly big. It was a comedy. And one of the people who was flying was American, and she let me have earphones. And so I listened in to an American movie, and I thought, oh my God, this is so fast, such fast English, this is gibberish. It's just, I wasn't getting it, you know, but I listened for like maybe 5 minutes. Then years later, I actually saw the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, oh wow, this is the movie they played when I was on the plane. Ah, that's so cool. Murdered by Death. When we got to America, in some ways, Italy was more America to me than America. You know, it was like, oh, I wonder if this is like that in the States. I wonder if this is what it tastes like in America. But they drove us down on 6th Avenue from the old airport. And I said, where are the skyscrapers? Because this is America to me. But of course, America is one-story buildings. It's suburbs, you know. And that was lacking in Denver. And then my father asked, where are the drunks?
The drunks?
The drunks. Because you have to, they're everywhere in Russia. Life is so hard that a hangover is preferable to reality. And you have like step over somebody on the street to get on, you're crossing the street, you step over somebody to get into the store, for example. They're just prevalent, they're just part of culture. So when my, like, where are the drugs? There's the streets were empty of people to begin with. Nobody walks in Denver anyway. And there weren't anyone lying around sleeping off, you know.
In the concrete.
Right. There's an old joke. Gorbachev was touring a factory, and he came to a foreman and he said, excuse me, do people come to work after they've been drinking a whole day? And the foreman said, well, yes, they do. Well, do they come to work after they've been drinking for 2 days? Yes, they do. They come to work after drinking for 3 days straight? The foreman said, well, I'm here, aren't I?
Well, I've been drinking for 3 days.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, it's just common. Just common thing for people to do that.
So your dad is like, why aren't there any drunks in here?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I think he might have been worried that there's no booze in here.
Oh. There's that too.
No, we found a liquor store. It's okay.
So you're driving from 6th Avenue down, like, here in Denver already?
Here in Denver.
Okay, so you're driving to your new home.
To our new home, the Jewish Community Center of Denver sponsored us.
Mm-hmm.
They basically got an apartment for us and paid for it until my parents got a job, and which is fantastic. My dad found a job working nights in Gates Rubber Company. It used to be big, fairly big company here in Denver. My mom, she was a nurse practitioner in Russia. My dad was an engineer, draftsman. And he started working nights, and my mom started working in a nursing home. And my mom was so tired. My dad would come pick her up. It was a few blocks from our house. My mom would say, move my feet for me, would you? And my dad was working nights. And one day, he delivered something to the engineering department. And he saw a blueprint. Now, my dad doesn't speak English very well at this point, but he knows math. He knows blueprints. He started talking, engineer to another engineer. This was the head of the department, and who knew that this guy knows stuff. He's wasting his, time shoveling coal in the basement or whatever he was doing. And he hired my dad pretty much on the spot. My dad calls my mom, and he says, listen, I got this job. It's an engineering, but it pays less than, working nights, janitorial. And my mom's like, take the job. I don't care how much, take the job. He calls her back, says, no, it pays more.
Oh, he meant more, not less. So she already agreed, even if it was less.
Yeah, she didn't care if it was less. It was the same job. And so my dad pretty much had the same job he had in the old country. My mom got she worked for Rose Hospital here in Denver as a phlebotomist. She drew blood. She was very good. They used to call her the mosquito.
That's a nickname you don't want to have, I think.
Well, I don't think you want the vampire.
Mosquito. Well, where I come from, mosquitoes are not very welcome.
True. She was so painless. She was really good. She was she liked people, and she did translating. They would call her in if they were Russian on the floor, Russian immigrants, and she would help the doctors. And the Russians knew that she was available. She would go out sometimes in the middle of the night, winter, because somebody would call her and they needed help. She was the closest thing people had to a medical professional who spoke. It wasn't a huge Russian population in, 40 plus years ago. So, but my mom was always doing that. She was always helping people. And
Did what your parents do in any way affect what you eventually studied and the career you chose and even the writing part of your life? Like, how did their own choices of jobs and career and ended up affecting your own decisions?
Not at all. I had trouble with math. And my father was a horrible teacher because it was so easy for him that he couldn't get why it was so difficult for me. And
did he blame your mom for the genes?
My mom loved the medicine. And so she said, why don't you, after you finish high school, I had no idea what to do. I was lost. She said, why don't you go into medical field? You'll always have a job. So I studied respiratory therapy until I became suicidal. And I thought, Mom, if I don't get out of this field, I will kill myself. She said, okay, fine, get out. I had a GPA of 1. Right? I didn't even think it's possible. I didn't think they'd kick you out of school if it get to that. So I had to get my GPA up, and I wanted to go to Colorado University up in Boulder. I love my parents, but I wanted to get away from them. I love them much more and much better from a distance. So I went to Denver Community College. I went to Metropolitan State College once I got it up, and I was ready to go. But I met the most incredible teacher. I've always been lucky. I've always had good English teachers. But this was a journalism, because I figured this is the closest thing I came to writing, majoring in journalism. And I met Mr. Greg Pearson, and he changed my life. He was 6'2", 6'3", he was a big guy. And when he would lecture, he would grow and he'd cuss. He used to be a drill instructor in the Marines.
Mm.
So he taught Marines how to be Marines. So when he taught, he would cuss and he would, I remember one time, the third lesson, he put his knuckles on the table and he was right in the face of this little girl sitting right next to me. And he was right in her face. Ah! And I thought, oh, I love him.
Okay. Yeah. Picturing that is like, this is classical music playing, and then you have these veins coming out in his face and spittle coming out of his mouth. It's like, oh, this is so cute.
Don't be fooled by his drill instructor demeanor. He cared deeply about these students. He would loan them money for school books, and some of them couldn't pay back. And that was okay with him. He didn't care. I sometimes would listen to him outside of the classroom, and I would sit there by the door just to hear him talk. And one time I was walking by, and he called me and he said, Elena, come here. I'm like, oh, God, crap, what did I do? So I'm standing in front of the students. And he says, Elena, you escaped from Soviet Union. I said, yes, sir. He said, I escaped from the nuns. You may go.
That's what he said?
Yep. The nuns, his mom couldn't raise him, so she gave him up to an orphanage run by Catholic nuns. And they were tough. They were tough. And the first chance he could, he signed up for Marines.
Oh.
Because that was a relief after the nuns.
Yeah. I kind of imagine what life would be like living with nuns.
Oh, yeah, he escaped. So if this guy who's 6'3 is talking about escaping from the nuns, you know they were not.
They were not cute.
Yep. I wrote an article about my migration for the Metropolitan, the newspaper. And they didn't cut out like a single word. It was like 500 words. It was a centerpiece. And I think it was that point that I was hooked on writing. I mean, I've always known that writing, I'm going to be a writer. I'm going to write something. But Mr. Pearson used to say, see your name in a byline is the most exciting thing you will ever happen to you. He wasn't wrong. Whether it's on a book, a dust jacket, or in a newspaper, just see your name by a published piece of work. Mr. Pearson used to say, unless you love to write, unless you have an almost biological urge to write, you're in the wrong business. Mm. And he never talked about talent. He always talked about perseverance and working hard. He said, he also taught us about the Go to Hell Fund. He said, you have to have a Go to Hell Fund because if some editor asks you to do something unethical, you tell him to go to hell. But you have a fund that you can fall back on. He said, I'm telling my kids this, and I'm telling you guys this. He used to say, I have a son who is an engineer, but he reads. It's okay, he reads. You know, like he was defending him. He's the runt of the litter. He's an engineer. He does math, but he reads.
So, after you see your name on the in the journal in the newspaper, what now changes in you? So you this it clicks. You want to now get into a lot of this. So how do you now take the steps towards improving your writing and being more prolific?
You know, I never forgot. I turned in a story. There was a history teacher, and I profiled him for the Metropolitan, and my editor, the editor said, this is a story. You have the who, the what, the when, but there's no color in it. There's nothing in there. So if you don't mind, go back and rewrite it and bring me a story where I can see the guy. So I started with a cigarette smoke curling from his cigarette in the ashtray when I was interviewing him. This is what I started from. And I brought him to life, just like the editor asked me to. And that was, I think that was most changing thing. It just changed my whole way of looking. It wasn't the journalism of the news. It was the journalism of feature stories and feature writing.
Creative storytelling.
Yep.
Yeah. Creative nonfiction, they call it.
Yeah, creative nonfiction, exactly. It used to be called new journalism. Joan Didion, Hunter S. Thompson, these people put you in the stories. And Mr. Pearson made sure we read these kind of new journalism stories full of color and description, and right in the middle of, you saw everything.
Yeah, when you say that, it reminds me of my friend, Zekasho Magviban, who actually writes some really interesting text stories that seem like outwardly, I mean like real life stories, but so beautifully written that you're like, I would like to see this person.
Right?
Yeah.
Somebody you want to have lunch with.
Exactly.
Or you wouldn't like to avoid them and walk across the street. Yeah.
Yeah. So your editor now opens your mind to this new world.
Yep.
What happens?
I fell in love with writing. I fell in love with the idea of bringing people to life, business to life. It doesn't matter how dry a thing was. I could make it interesting. I could make it visual. I could make it exciting.
The way you say it, it sounds like you almost call him your mentor, the Marine, the ex-Marine. What's his name?
Mr. Pearson.
Mr. Pearson. Put this light of writing is not just about talent. It's about the discipline and perseverance. And I'm hoping they could actually expand on that and what you've learned yourself about getting better at writing. Because many people think that writing or art as a whole is like, oh, you have to be born with something. You have to have the skill. You have to. Some people tell me, oh, you're a good writer. You're lucky. You've been writing for a long time or something. It's like you have these innate abilities to do whatever it is. But what I'm hearing from you is you can learn how to do these things. So how can someone listening right now choose to learn how to write better?
It's the same way you can choose to learn to draw better. When you look at a chair, you study the shade and the shape of the chair. And if you see the chair, you can draw it. And the more you draw this chair, the better it will look like the chair, the more it will look like itself. When you write, when you choose the words that best describe whatever it is you write about, say the chair. Maybe it's wicker, maybe it's metal, maybe it's plastic. Whatever the chair is, the words you use to describe it becomes your medium. and you get to, you have complete, you are the god of your chair. You create your world with your words. And they don't have to be big, and they don't have to be schmancy. They have to be your words. Nobody, no English teacher ever is going to say to you, you should write like this other person. They always are going to tell you, write like yourself, right? So nobody ever gets talker's block, right? We don't stop in the middle of a sentence going, I forgot words. I mean, maybe if I'm 90. But if you think you have writer's block, all you have to do is start talking and words will come. If you want to be a writer, if you want to be in charge of your world, well, we have no control in the world. None. We have zero. Whatever control you think you have is an illusion. But when we write, we are gods. We are creators. We can create people and worlds and everything. And it's the cheapest form of entertainment. As far as you just need, you know, a dollar notebook and a dollar pen, and you get to sit down and you become a god. I mean, where?
A word from my sponsors. This podcast is fully funded by my wife and my supporters on Patreon.com. If you love what you're listening and you like to keep me reaching out to more guests, paying for hosting, software, and all costs related to this podcast, head on to patreon.com/kamgachasa and feel free to pick any of the 5 tiers, starting with $1. If push comes to shove, your support will be what allows me to pay for bills and do this work. So support the Loving Creative Podcast on patreon.com/kamgachasa. patreon.com/kamgachasa. Now, back to our conversation.
I mean, you're saying a dollar is like 500 francs CFA in Cameroon, and that's like, you can buy a pen and an eraser and a pencil and a notebook with $500, so.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And you're set for, you sit down and you create.
And what's your take on digital creation? Like, we live in a world now where almost everybody is creating something somewhere, whether it's Facebook, Instagram. Some people say, oh, that's a waste of time. Other people say that's where they build their businesses. What's your personal take on improving your craft as a creator, writer, with all these tools available?
Anything that helps you is fine by me. Just because I like a pencil or, you know, a pen and a notebook, that's not the right way. There is no wrong way to create. If a computer helps you, if it helps you create a piece of music, a piece of art, or a world, or a person, then I'm all for that. Absolutely. And furthermore, I think that it doesn't matter who you are. If you are a doctor, a lawyer, Indian chief, or a garbage collector, if you know how to make a sentence, that makes you a creative. And it's a vital skill. Vital skill, but all it is a skill. It's not magic. Nobody is born magical. We're all born babies. Everybody's born the same, right? Stephen King started writing when he was 14, 15. He started trying to get into magazines. Now, Stephen King is not like you and I. And I'll admit it now. Not this.
I saw an interview, Stephen King and George R. R. Martin of Game of Thrones, and wait, we're talking about prolificness. Apparently, Stephen King writes every single day, all the time, like, no matter what. Even when he had his surgery, what brought him back to life was writing. It's like, he's a machine.
Yes.
Yeah, almost like Danielle Steele. I was reading also this article about how she's published, what, over hundreds of books. Anyway, yeah.
Well, Stephen King said in his book on writing, he said, I'm just like everyone else. I put my pants on one leg at a time, blah, blah, blah. That's not true. I mean, maybe he puts his pants on one leg at a time.
Maybe he poops.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe. We're not sure. But he wrote Cujo completely drunk. He doesn't remember writing Cujo. He said, that's too bad. It's one of my favorite books. This is what makes him different than you and I. Okay? If I were to be blitzed, there's no way I could write a masterpiece or
what's
a great book.
Blitz?
Drunk.
Oh, okay.
He is an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And he started drinking when he was, I think, 16 as well. Writing and drinking pretty much go together. So Yeah, I don't think he's the same as everyone. If you get drunk and then you write this book, you know, there's just no way. It's not in me. But again, this is a man who had a hook, right? He had a hook for all the rejection letters since he was 15 years old. He would put the rejections on the hook. And when the hook was the rejections were too heavy,
the hook fell.
Yep. He built a bigger hanger to put the rejections on, you know? So as far as that, he works at writing just like everyone else. Mm. And that's all it takes.
Mr. Pierce. Easy though?
Yes.
Yes. Sorry for cutting off. Yeah.
You know, no. What he does is, wherever he is, whether it's birthday or Christmas or he's traveling, he's going to find a place to sit down and write. That's what makes him a writer. No sheets of paper without any words on it in his house.
When you say that aspect of him being an alcoholic, and I said that I've not finished reading on writing, but I read some parts of it, realizing, for example, that he had a job while he was writing, and even when he got the money for, was it a carry?
Yeah,
when he got the money for it, he actually still didn't want to quit his job as a teacher because he was like, I don't know how to take care of my family. Like, this might not work. So even Stephen King wasn't as confident as most people think that he might have been, knowing that his book was going to have, you know, this movie and everything. And I wonder, like, the whole idea of this podcast is to find out, is it possible to be a happy, loving, to live a happy, full life as a creative? And I don't know what you think about the whole idea of addiction or trouble, whether it's mental health issues or having to sacrifice things and having to deal with pain to create, not just as writers, but as people who want to make things. What do you think is necessary to keep in mind as a creative in order not to fall in these, you know, spirals of destructive behavior that people now associate with creativity? Because I don't think you have to have these destructive things to be a creator. Like, you could destroy, you know, characters in the book, that's okay. But in your life, how do you not get to that place?
You have to understand that one has nothing to do with the other. It used to be, you want to be a reporter, you have to be hard drinking, smoking, you know, one of those tough people in the business. But the truth is, you really don't. You don't have to destroy your body or your mind to be creative. You don't have to be Hemingway and become an alcoholic to write. All you have to do is write. You don't have to do anything destructive to become an artist. You have to draw. You have to paint.
Do you think everybody's creative?
Yes. I think everybody's creative whether they realize it or not, or I think everybody can become creative if they want to. This isn't rocket surgery. This is really...
Rocket surgery?
Rocket science and brain surgery together again.
Yep.
For the first time.
Rocket brain.
Yep. All you have to do is use whatever free time you have.
But the way you say it sounds so simple. It's like, yeah, people have these arguments of, oh yeah, you can say that because you have time. You can say that because you, like, some people now might, let's say I'm doing this podcast right now. I'm uploading this, and like, oh yeah, you say, oh, you can start a podcast because you are in a place where you're allowed to start a podcast. Like, how does somebody who doesn't have access to the tools do what we're doing?
Let's say you want to start a podcast. You want to interview people. Nothing is stopping you from talking to people. You come up and you meet people and you talk with them and you find them interesting. You write about it and you find a place like the Medium, which is supremely affordable.
$5 a month to be a member. I feel like it's a big deal. It's like where I come from is $2,500 a month and there are people who can afford it. But then people look at the pros and the cons and they're like, well, why should I pay to read?
Right.
But then you want to be a writer, and you want people to pay for your writing, which is weird.
Unfortunately, you cannot be a writer unless you're also a reader. You just can't. It's inseparable. I want to say, you want to be a writer, write. Yes, absolutely, 100%. But also, if you want to be a writer, read.
Aren't you worried that what you read can affect your own writing?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, I tend to, whenever I read somebody, I tend to kind of become... My style of thinking becomes the way these people talk, the characters in the book. Yes, absolutely, 100%. And I have zero problems with that because it's the people that I'm going to create, they're going to be their own people, you know. And if I'm influenced by a book, then it's a good book, you know. If it's going to change the way I think, fantastic. Then this is how I'm going to think. When I read Hemingway, I tend to think in short, simple sentences.
I've never read any Hemingway. Yeah, it's one of those. I've never watched Titanic. I've never done a bunch of things.
Well, you know how Titanic ends, right?
Yeah.
There you go. I've never seen Titanic either. Okay. We know how it ends.
That's what we need to do.
Exactly. But I suggest you read a couple of short stories by Hemingway, because then you can really make fun of him. There was Why Did the Chicken Cross the Road? And they had answers in different people, like Colonel Sanders, Kentucky Fried Chicken. I missed one. Or Hemingway, to die alone in the rain.
Wow, that is, yeah, I can see how. And let's talk a little bit about voice. I know you're working on a book right now, and we are the writers group that invited you to Kim, and somebody was asking, what is voice? What does it mean? Basically, what's voice?
It is your own outlook of life. When you talk, you have a certain way of talking. Everybody does. So when your characters speak, they will have, or should have, their own voices. In theory, the idea of, you don't even have to have labels. You know, Sarah said, John replied, you don't even have to have their names, because their voices should be so different and unique to them that you can read the entire thing knowing who said what.
It looks like it takes skill to develop that.
Everything takes time. Everything takes time. There's no way you know how to make bread unless you start making bread, and then you keep making bread and making different kinds of bread. If you want to eat bread, if you want to be a baker, you have to bake. If you want to be a writer, you have to write, and you have to read. Because you don't know who you are unless you go through the process of reading other people and you say, my God, this is me. The reason we read the classics and we call them the classics is that because they contain the people we know and the situations we know. Everything has changed from the turn of the century to 2019. And yet, when we read Edgar Allan Poe, even though the language could be a little outdated, he creates atmosphere that is so dense and heavy and macabre and dark that you are there. And that's what makes it a classic, because he transports you, because the people are real. Because when somebody is hearing a heartbeat through the floor, you're freaking out. You know? Shakespeare is Shakespeare for a reason. Because Shakespeare knew women better than any other writer. Some people say, oh, no, Shakespeare was a woman. Probably. It could be. I can see it. This is how well Shakespeare wrote about women. When Shakespeare writes, and by the way, I do not advocate anybody read Shakespeare. I advocate people watch Shakespeare. Plays and movies, he wrote plays and movies, which are terrific, tremendous. If you have not seen Kenneth Branagh, Henry V, go out and find the movie somewhere, because it's terrific. It's a tremendous movie. The language of the bard. Romeo and Juliet. There was a movie recently, and they put it on. They put it in modern times. But the language they left, and it's amazing to hear. It is just breathtakingly good. And I don't think he was born any different than anyone else. He was born a baby like everyone else. And he wrote, you know.
When you say that, I remember Sir Ken Robinson's TED Talk about education and creativity, where he asked the audience to imagine Shakespeare in English class and Shakespeare trying to go to bed. And his dad telling him to go to bed. And him, you know, correcting his dad. And how, like, just picture Shakespeare as a baby, you know, in an English class. how would he sound like? Just wondering. Yeah, it's an interesting position to be. And I wonder if throughout your journey, you've already mentioned Mr. Pierce, Who else did you have as mentors, both, you know, physically and whereas this digitally or whatever it was? Were there other people on your journey who made you feel like this was a possible path and this is a thing that you could do?
I had an English teacher. Oh, I forgot her name. She was tremendous. She was terrific. First of all, she was the first teacher I've ever seen wearing sneakers. I'm like, wow, you can do that? I didn't think you were allowed. Second of all, at the end of the class, if you're done with your work, you could do whatever you want. And I would take out a book and I would read a book. And usually I'd bring classics. But I really got into this series called Alfred Hitchcock and the Three Investigators. Mm. And it was kind of like bubblegum for the mind. That were popular at the time. I had no idea that she paid any attention to me until one day she came and said, "You're reading this? You always bring such good books and you're reading this now?" Which shocked me. I didn't realize. But I said, "This is easy. Really easy to read." Mm-hmm. She's like, "I guess." She wasn't impressed. She didn't say, "Stop reading that." You know. But it was like reading, it was like potato chips. It was just super easy to read. Another English teacher, I used to bring my parents over to the English classes first, for parent-teacher night, and then the math. I'm like, yeah, algebra not so good, but hey, check out, talk to my English teacher. The first time I discovered freedom, true freedom, I took my dad to see an English teacher, whose name escapes me. I'm horrible with names. Names, faces, and that third thing I always forget. I took him to see my English teacher, and he was saying, "Oh, Elena's wonderful. She is so curious. We had a fire drill. She was looking at the fire drug. She's so good, blah, blah, blah. She's so funny. She has a great sense of humor." And my father was preening. He was, "Well, she gets that from me." And he said, the teacher said, "No, sir, she gets that from God." And for the first time in my life, there was something that was not necessarily gotten from my parents. I look like my parents. Everything but my nose that I broke when I was a kid. I talk like my parents. I owe my parents my soul for getting me out of there. But this, suddenly, there was something that was not dependent on my parents. I could breathe. I was like, oh, wow. I don't own my parents 100%, maybe 95%. I could make myself something. It was such amazing freedom. And then, of course, all the books that I've read. When I was 10 years old, I discovered my parents used to take magazines and they would bind them. So we'd have a collection of magazines bound like a book. And what people would do, they would print like series, right, books, and they would be bound together. And I discovered them, and I read Georges Simenon. He's a French writer. He created a character called Maigret. Maigret was a police detective. But, of course, he's French. So there's a great deal of food and drink to the police station. They go to lunch. He comes home, and Madame Maigret has dinner ready. He describes everything that they're eating and taking a walk. They're describing the food. I have no idea what Maigret looks like, except he has moustache. And Madame Maigret is kind of a traditionally built woman. But otherwise, we have no idea what they look like, but I know what they had for lunch every day, you know? And of course, there are mysteries. And I remember reading about this man. He was shot with a bullet, but the bullet was sharpened. And so for a while, they were thinking, why would they sharpen it? Because he hated him so much. He just wanted to make sure he got him. But in truth, an unsharpened bullet would do more damage. And after I read that, it still stays with me to this day. I remember thinking, well, that's brilliant. He was so angry he wanted to sharpen the bullet, you know, just to get him more. But he didn't know that an unsharpened bullet, you know, that kind of thing. It pointed to the anger of the killer. And I think it was then I fell in love with mysteries. And the idea of reading something where you match wits with the writer or the detective, that to me became powerful in that it's every really great work of literature contains a mystery. you look, even if it's a love story, you know, a Rebecca, you still have this mystery at the heart of it. It doesn't matter. There's always the best books contain a kernel of you have to dig for the mystery. You know, there's something unspoken, something just to be discovered. Once I found that, I was like, oh, this is it. This is my niche. This is, and I started reading just mysteries. Mm. I should say, not just, but 95% of what I read are mysteries.
Okay. Is there something that when you started your journey as a writer, you thought was true, but with time and everything happening in life and writing, you've tend to look at it and like, that isn't as true as I thought. Was there any misconceptions that you had?
Not in that.
Not just in mystery world, like in your overarching
writing.
Yeah.
I think the biggest thing that I've discovered, and I'm still fighting that every day, is the fact that my ego gets in my own way more than anything else. I get in my own way. Nobody else gets in my own way like I do. And my ego is so strong, the fear is so strong, that every day there is that huge struggle of, you know, you're not a real writer, you're a poser. You've never written a book. You don't have an agent. I know this is your dream, but you're not real.
And what do you say to that?
Well, sometimes I give in, I go to bed, and I cry for an hour. But most of the time, I can't spend my life that way. I say, maybe I'm not a real writer, but I'm going to pretend I am today. Tomorrow, I don't know. And maybe I don't have an editor or an agent right now, but if I write long enough, I will get it. And maybe I am a poser, but I'd rather be a poser writer than anything else.
That is powerful. I feel like that can carry you a long way to even discovering that you actually are a writer. Because if I remember clearly, even Maya Angelou, after everything she had done, still felt that they were going to write her out. She's gonna, the whole imposter syndrome, she's like one of the biggest examples of people who have done these amazing things but still feel like I'm not good enough. And it's something that I struggle with myself, and it feels like you either just learn to look at it and smile like, I know where this is coming from, I'm going to do my job. Like, I think if you treat writing like a job, it's no longer about inspiration and feeling. It's like, all right, I need to get better at this whole phrasal verb thing. Let me get a book and read and practice. And that's a powerful way to look at it.
Yeah. You know, people say, maybe I should go to college. And I would never discourage anyone from going to college. But the truth of the matter is, if you can't afford to go to college, or you don't really want to go to college, or you don't want to become dirt poor by going to college and get in debt like everyone else, then what you do is you read classics and you treat art with a capital A and beauty with a capital B, but don't let it interfere work with a small W. Because even though we have these lofty ideas of, you know, art and beauty, and we elevate it, we pay artists crap, you know? And in truth, it's nothing but work. That's all it is. All creativity can be created. Literally, you can create yourself. Life isn't about discovering yourself. Life is about creating yourself. This is George Bernard Shaw. He said that. And I totally believe that. Because every day you wake up, you're a new person. You may be high, you may be low, but you are different. You're always different. And it's up to you to say, who am I today? Am I a writer? Then I better write. Am I an artist? I better draw. You know, maybe they're not going to pay you. Maybe they will never pay you. But you don't know unless you do the job and you work at it.
Well, that was for me. So if you're listening and you're enjoying this, you have Lena to thank.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, so we're going to go now into the rapid fire section. It usually varies depending on who I'm with, but it's really just a series of questions around content you're consuming, your view on the world. So we'll just get straight. So let's talk about, what book are you reading right now?
It's called Money in the Morgue by Nye Marsh.
What is it about?
It's
fiction, nonfiction.
It's fiction. Mm-hmm. It's a mystery. Surprise. It takes place in New Zealand in during the war, 1943-44, something like that, and in a hospital. There have been a death, and then there has been a theft. Mm. But there's an inspector there from the Scotland Yard, New Scotland Yard, and he's going to solve it.
Mm. Okay. And let's now go to top favorite writers. You can list up to three.
Robert P. Parker, God rest his soul. He wrote Spencer for Hire series. And let's see, number two. Christopher Fowler writes a series of mysteries that take place in London. Peculiar Crime Unit. Hilarious, ridiculously funny. Not light subjects, but I always learn something about London. Mm. Always fantastic, fascinating things. And in a light, brilliant way, super easy to read. Third favorite writer. Oh, it's so hard. I just wrote an article about that too. So many.
Pick one.
Okay. Let's go with the classics. Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes, the great detective. I will always love him. He is always going to be real to me. And I don't care who plays him on TV, in the movies.
You don't? But who do you prefer?
I love Johnny Lee Miller, who does Elementary.
Mm.
He does a very good job.
Okay. I thought you'd say Robert Downey Jr. or Cumberbatch, because I love both.
I do too. I do too. Cumberbatch more, because he is a Brit.
Yeah. He's very Holmesy.
Yeah, right? High functioning psychopath.
No,
sociopath. Yeah. Yes. Learn the difference. Mm-hmm. I do like Benedict Cumberbatch. And they could have like a dwarf, an albino dwarf playing Sherlock Holmes.
And you're still going to love it.
I would still love it.
Okay. Now movies. Favorite movies.
Ooh, now that's, I love movies. Okay. I love movies. Wait, it'll come to me. Anything with Jackie Chan in it.
Okay.
I love comedies. I love action. I love comedic action. And let me see. L.A. Confidential is one of my favorite movies. Not a comedy, but noir.
Is it a movie or a show?
It's a movie.
Okay.
The Usual Suspects.
Mm, yeah. 1994. I love the movie.
Yeah, right? anything by Kenneth Branagh, although I don't recommend Hamlet. He did a four-hour Hamlet. Mm. And he put it in like 1800s Russia, which is really weird. But 4 hours, yeah, no. But otherwise, Dead Again. I love that movie. Kenneth Branagh, Emma Thompson.
Okay.
Dead Again. It's a mystery.
Mm.
Wonderful.
All right. Now, TV shows.
Ooh, so many.
Three. Yes.
Of all time or now?
What are you watching now, and then three of all time?
Okay. Right now, I'm watching Elementary.
Of course.
It's the very last season. Yeah. So, but I love it. I love Frasier. One of my favorite shows, Frasier. Ridiculous.
Who wrote that show? Was it? Is it the same person who wrote The West Wing? No.
No, Aaron Sorkin. You're thinking Aaron Sorkin.
I thought it was Aaron Sorkin.
I anything he does, Aaron Sorkin is fantastic.
Yeah, he's my screenwriting idol.
He is wonderful. I do love West Wing.
Mm-hmm.
And let me see. Law and Order, Criminal Intent.
Mm.
The original Law and Order, absolutely. Criminal Intent. The first couple of years.
Criminal Intent, is this the most Criminal Minds or something else?
No, it's Law and Order.
Okay.
So it was like.
Oh, so there's Law and Order, Criminal Intent.
Right.
Oh.
It's not on the air now.
Mm-hmm.
Law and Order isn't on the air either. Special Victims Unit is. Mm. It's the only one that's left.
SVI.
Yeah.
Oh, it's SVU.
SVU, yeah. Mm-hmm. Which I loved Criminal Intent because it was like a true mystery. And the main character, the policeman, he was like Sherlock Holmes.
Okay.
And CSI when it was going on. Oh.
Which one?
The original. Mm. Yeah, the very, very Las Vegas.
Do you watch any cartoons, animations?
Oh, yeah. I love, and they're bringing back Bugs Bunny.
Oh,
the really? Classics. They're bringing the classics back.
Okay.
I love, let me think, Rick and Morty.
Oh, yeah. November 2019, season 4 is out. Oh, I'm waiting for yes. it. Yes.
yeah, I do. I enjoy it. I remember being a kid, having a glass of milk and a bunch of cookies and just watching Saturday morning cartoons. Just everything, Hanna-Barbera, you know, Flintstones, Jetstones, just Bugs Bunny. Always comes back to Bugs Bunny.
Awesome. So is there anything else that I left out when we're talking about you? Is there something you would like to add or remove?
No, I really appreciate being here. I feel ridiculously special, like everyone else.
You are special.
Oh, thank you. And thank you so much.
You're welcome. Since you're here, I actually want to thank you for all the cups of coffee that we've bought ever since we met and the beautiful conversation we've had about the old country and the new country and what it means to have an immigrant friend you can talk to who understands what it means to move to a new country.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Elena.
You're welcome.
All right. So where can we find you? I know we can find you on Medium, but I know your email too has an aspect of your mystery. But so if somebody's listening right now and they want to get in contact with you, first of all, one, what do you need help with? Like, is there something that you're doing right now you might need assistance on? And two, where can we find you?
The only thing I need help on is fighting my ego every day. And unfortunately, that's a fight I have to do all by myself. Mm. If anybody wants to contact me, my email is mysterystrumpet.
Of course.
One word, yep. Mysterystrumpet. I'm going to bring strumpet back. Mm-hmm. @gmail.com. And if you're an editor or if you're an agent, yeah, hello.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to spill any beans on your book because I have this weird, I don't want to jinx it, like this whole idea of, I don't talk about ideas that I have because I feel like when you talk about them, you have this good feeling and then you never do it. So we're not going to talk about the book in the hopes that in some near future, I'll be announcing the fact that your book is out and then people can now find it. So yeah.
Yes.
So good luck on the book, Kalina, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to this episode of the Loving Creative Podcast with me, Kamga Chasa. Was there a part of the episode that really resonated with you? Or is there someone in your life that you think would really benefit from listening to this episode of the podcast? I do hope you take the time to share with them. And why not with your social media following, Facebook, Instagram, whatever works for you would definitely work for me. And I would ask just one thing that you consider leaving a comment, a rating, and a review on iTunes. That would really mean the world to me. That's it. So have a great day and thank you for taking the time to spend this moment with me. I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.